BBC Radio 3 new generation artist Benjamin Grosvenor playing Chopin's second scherzo. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 7:30 and time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Petroc Trelawney.
Good evening. A warm welcome back to the proms and an absolutely packed Royal Albert Hall this Saturday night. There's something a little old-fashioned about the length of service David Zinman has given the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra. In an era when conductors move around far more than they used to, his 16 seasons as music director have seen him turn a once provincial orchestra into one of Europe's finest. He's happy in Switzerland, and the city and its orchestra are clearly happy with him. He's just signed up for another 3 years in Zurich. Well, as the Tonhalle musicians take their place on the stage here, we can prepare ourselves for what should be a terrific Saturday evening concert, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony after the interval. And in the first half, one of the season's big stars, the Portuguese pianist Maria João Pires, will play Mozart's final piano concerto. It is, she says, a meditative piece, and the challenge, the beautiful challenge, is to get 5,001 people meditating together. Well, Maria João Pires will be on stage in just over 1/4 hour's time. We're going to start with the UK premiere of a work by the Swedish composer Anders Hillborg. Cold Heat was written last year and first heard in January when Zinman conducted the piece with the Berlin Philharmonic. Give me something with no slow music whatsoever. That was David Zinman's request to Hillborg, but the conductor didn't quite get what he was after.
Yes, and he disappointed me because it's not slow music. I mean, it's fast, but a lot of the general harmonic motion is slow until the middle section, which is very fast and rock and roll and kind of ballistic. And then it goes back to the slow, and then it ends very beautifully and very slowly. But it's a beautiful piece on its own, even though someday I said to him, Anders, I want, like, from beginning to end, 10 minutes of rock and roll. He said, I promise. So we'll see what happens.
David Zinman, and here he comes, making his way onto the platform as the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra rise to their feet. We open tonight's BBC Prom with the UK premiere of Cold Heat by Anders Hillborg. UK premiere of Cold Heat by Anders Hillborg. David Zimmern conducting the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra. Anders Hillborg making his way to the center of the stage. Warm embrace for David Zimmern. In his late 50s, he studied in Stockholm, where Brian Ferneyhough was one of his teachers, played in a rock band for many years, playing guitar alongside Jan Sandstrom, he of the Motorbike Concerto. Hillborg has a long association with the Proms. Liquid Marble, Exquisite Corpse, and Peacock Tales, three of his works, all given UK premieres here between 1997 and 2008. Swirling sounds from the woodwind during that piece, one of the key influences reflected in it, sight of a flock of birds, eider birds, wheeling over the sea. Well, if you've just joined us, welcome back to the Proms. bbc.co.uk/proms, the place where you can view tonight's programme. Look on screen at exactly the document we have in front of us here at the Royal Albert Hall. Now, they're aiming on 3.5 minutes to move the piano tonight, which may be something close to the season's record. I wonder how they'll do. The piano being moved in place for Maria João Pires to play Mozart's Piano Concerto K-595 in B-flat. This is the work that's usually described as his final concerto, a work of farewell, as one 20th century musicologist described it. History has it that the piece was completed on the 5th of January 1791. May indeed have been finished on that date, but modern research suggests that it was actually drafted in incomplete score as early as 1788, 3 years before Mozart's death. It is at heart a gentle piece, expressing weariness, a little resignation, perhaps even a sense of being fed up with life in the spotlight. Earlier I asked Maria João Pires what she thought was the mood of the concerto.
It's very cosmic, very much a cosmic mood. You have very much the feeling of the global Mozart, the Mozart that can be everywhere at the same time. It's something very special. The end of his life, the last sonatas and the last concertos have also this coming back to this simplicity and something that is not proving anything anymore, and it's just...
And looking back over this lifetime of experience, I suppose...
Even though we don't know if he was knowing that he was approaching his death, but it's something that perhaps you don't need to know, perhaps it's something that is there.
It's the magic of Mozart in some ways, isn't it?
Yes.
It's why he speaks so universally as a composer.
Yes. It's very true, very honest, very direct. It's nothing hide it, there are no games.
And David Zimmern says that's how this piece should be performed. It's a piece that the music will absolutely speak for itself.
Yeah, I must say David Zimmern is also kind of a miracle. His way of understanding Mozart is so incredible. I'm always very impressed because when I'm playing, I feel so relaxed when he's conducting. It's also something you cannot explain.
How is it to be back at the Proms? You were here a year ago playing the late night Chopin recital. It was one of the great highlights of the 2010 season. Is it a festival that you look forward to taking part in?
I love this festival, and this place is also magic. very much magic, yes. I like this place. Although sometimes alone on stage, I was expecting to be very stressed, and in the end, I was not so much. I was okay.
You said you want us to all meditate.
Yes,
together this evening,
exactly.
During the Mozart.
It's the best way. We should not expect to have the brilliant Mozart, but the simple one.
Maria João Pires talking to me earlier on this afternoon. Well, I'm afraid they haven't quite managed the 3.5 minutes, but pretty close. I think about 4 minutes we'll be looking at for total duration of the move. Julia Becker, who is concertmaster of the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra, giving the A. This is the only one of Mozart's last eight concertos to include his own cadenzas, implying that it might have been written for a pupil to play rather than Mozart himself. Several musicologists have argued that if he was writing it for himself, he would have created a more brilliant work. That said, on March the 4th, 1791, the Czech clarinetist Josef Beer organised a concert in Vienna, which Mozart played a piano concerto, almost certainly this one, K-595. And here is Maria Jalpieres with David Zinman to join the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra here at the Proms in Mozart's Piano Concerto number 27 in B-flat, K-595. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Zinman tapping his baton on the piano to applaud Maria Zsapérés. After that performance of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 27, B-flat Major Concerto K-595, Mozart's final piano concerto, performed here at the Proms with the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra. What an atmosphere there was here in the Royal Albert Hall during that performance. Eager anticipation. The audience patiently waiting for the simplicity of the concerto to unfold itself. It is, says Maria Zsapérés, so pure and simple that one has to prepare one's own mood to suit the piece rather than try and influence the music. Here she is back on the platform again, wearing a very simple grey and black tiered dress. Portuguese pianist, but now lives in Brazil in a simple little house, as she describes it, near the sea in Salvador de Bahia. And there she continues the great passion in her life, working with underprivileged children. She's established an educational project there based around a children's choir. As she puts it, the cheapest, the most organic way to make a child feel a human being and not garbage. She returns now with David Zinman, who brings the woodwind players to their feet, and now the whole orchestra. Who can forget that late-night Chopin rehearsal, late-night Chopin recital that Maria Zsapérés gave last year here at the Proms? One of the highlights of the season. One critic wrote, Pérez seems so perfectly at ease, as if she was playing for a few friends at home. Tonight, her sixth appearance at the BBC Proms. I have the best memories of playing at the Proms because the atmosphere in the hall is unique and the mood, she says, is almost magic. And does not feel alone on stage, but very much together with the audience. And the audience don't want to bid her adieu quite yet. Here she comes once again. With David Zinman again, clasping her hands, acknowledging audience and orchestra. Small orchestra and a large stage this evening, of which she stands alone at the front of it right now, bowing, almost curtsying to the audience. She and David Zinman leave the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, it's 27 minutes past 8, BBC Radio 3 at the Proms this Saturday. The final work on the programme is Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. We'll hear that performed by David Zinman and the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra in 20 minutes' time. First of all, we join Susan Hitch for tonight's Proms Plus, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello and welcome to tonight's Proms literary event. Matthew Barley is the third guest in this year's four-part series of musicians from this year's Proms introducing their favourite literature. He's one of the most dynamic, skilled, musical and adventurous cellists of our time. His late night prom earlier this month was a typical and absolutely joyful mixture of classical, Hungarian folk and jazz in his own arrangements, played with his wife, the great violinist Victoria Mulova, and Julian Joseph, all the intimacy and urgency of good music-making with friends, but on the scale of the Albert Hall. And we're delighted to have the distinguished actor Charles Dance read the passages Matthew's chosen. He's been a household name since he played Guy Perrin in The Jewel in the Crown and innumerable roles since, though I'm particularly partial to his line in Smooth Menace. Think of the lawyer Tulkinghorn in Bleak House. He's currently in HBO's TV series Game of Thrones, and he also directs films like Ladies in Lavender. Please welcome them both. Matthew, what do you hope to find when you open a book?
Well, it's a good question. I think really the most important thing that I look for is just to be moved. And obviously that can come in many, many different shapes and sizes, but I want some kind of emotional engagement with the book.
But you've chosen big intellectual books here to be emotionally moved by.
Some of them big intellectual books, but all very moving in their own way, and I'm sure we can go into some details later, but they've all stayed with me on an emotional level.
Let's hear our first reading then. It's from James Joyce's huge novel Ulysses, set in Dublin on one day. Here we've reached lunchtime, and we're seeing through the eyes of Leopold Bloom, Joyce's central character. Charles.
Perched on high stools by the bar, hats shoved back, at the tables calling for more bread, no charge, swilling, wolfing gobfuls of sloppy food, their eyes bulging, wiping wetted moustaches. A pallid, suet-faced young man polished his tumbler, knife, fork and spoon with his napkin, new set of microbes. A man with an infant sauce-stained napkin tucked around him shoveled gurgling soup down his gullet. A man spitting back on his plate half-masticated gristle. No teeth to chew it. Chomp-chop from the grill. Bolting to get it over. Sad boozer's eyes. Bitten off more than he can chew. Am I like that? See ourselves as others see us. Hungry man is an angry man, working tooth and jaw. Don't! Oh, a bone! That last pagan king of Ireland, Cormac, in the school poem, choked himself at Sletty, southward of the Boyne. Wonder what he was eating. Something galoptious. St. Patrick converted him to Christianity. Couldn't swallow it all, however.
Thank you, Charles. Matthew, we're eavesdropping on Leopold's thought processes there. I mean, how do you think that works?
Well, I think what I find so wonderful about this entire book, I mean, the entire book takes place within 24 hours, and it's really a whole book about what goes on inside a man's head in 24 hours. And for me, it just works wonderfully. I carry this book around with me in my own head just because it feels so like what goes on in my own head all the time. And I mean, in one way, yes, it's a very intellectual book. It's supposedly quite difficult to read. But in the other, you know, in that extract we just heard, it's very sensual in the sense of it's all about the senses all the time. And it doesn't read like anything dry at all. It's just it kind of hits you between it and makes you laugh as well. It's wonderful.
I wonder whether it had something to do with the musician's kind of active engagement with all sorts of different kinds of thought at the same time. There's the sensory and the intellectual and the emotional and the cerebral.
Definitely. I mean, what I find in my own head, and I suspect that we're all like that, is that thoughts constantly interrupt one another, and there's a whole sort of miasma of different layers of thoughts going on, and some of them are very wordy and sort of sentence defined, you know, with proper grammar and things, and others aren't at all. And as you read Ulysses, there are, well, famously, the last 80 pages or something has no punctuation whatsoever, not even a comma in the word he's, as in here's, nothing at all. But in other sections of the book, you'll find that he splits up sentences every two or three words. He'll stick a full stop in, and there'll be lots of commas and colons and things. And in that way, it all seems incredibly musical to me because it varies its pace all the time. And once you've read Ulysses, it's striking how few authors actually experiment and play with their punctuation.
And that timing of things like choo, 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 chomp, chops.
Exactly, exactly. It's so pleasing and it's so, I don't know, are your heads like that? Mine is.
Your second choice is also about compassion coming out of surprising circumstances. It's from Mr. God, This Is Anna, which is a book set in the streets of the East End in the 30s. Finn is the adolescent narrator, and he finds a runaway four-year-old. She's squatting over a grating, she's hungry and tired, and as it turns out, ill-treated. He picks her up and takes her home to his mother to be looked after.
Anna's misery was for others. They just could not see the beauty of that broken iron stump, the colours, the crystalline shapes. They could not see the possibilities there. Anna wanted them to join with her in this exciting new world, but they could not imagine themselves to be so small that this jagged fracture could become a world of iron mountains, of iron plains with crystal trees. It was a new world to explore, a world of the imagination, a world where few people would or could follow her. In this broken-off stump was a whole new realm of possibilities to be explored and to be enjoyed.
Charles, thank you. Matthew, this book makes me cry. Do you cry over books?
Totally. And in fact, I read this in my 20s, and in my 20s I didn't cry. And I'd never really thought about the fact that I never cried until I read this book. And I remember really distinctly in my slightly grotty bedsit in West Kensington, suddenly tears pouring down my cheeks and thinking, God, I haven't done this for years. I mean, now I'm hopeless. I cry at Disney films. I'm there for the manipulation of Hollywood. My children laugh at me. But in those days, it was very rare. And it's interesting that it was a book that did that. And it's when Anna dies at the end. It's a very extraordinary scene. And I think, I don't know, reading is such an extraordinary activity. It's so private, you know, it's just you and this object, this paper in front of you. And to be moved to tears in that circumstance is very, very special.
But it's also about children, isn't it? And about the relationship with children.
Very much. It's a book for me that I've used many, many times as an inspiration for both parenting and teaching.
Why?
Because I was very excited when someone pointed out to me many, many years ago that the word education, the root of it is the Latin educare, which means to draw out. Whereas my experience of education was all these people trying to force stuff into me. And the idea of education being something drawn out of a pupil was very exciting to me.
Well, your next choice is also about the acquisition of wisdom in the way that Anna gives wisdom to Finn. Mm-hmm. Hermann Hesse, struggling with his own experience of philosophical depression, Lebenskrankheit, sickness of life, in the 1920s, turned to the story of a Nepalese monk, Siddhartha. Charles.
Siddhartha stayed with the ferryman and learned how to look after the boat. And when there was nothing to do at the ferry, he worked in the rice field with Vasudeva, gathered wood and picked fruit from the banana trees. He learned how to make oars, how to improve the boat and to make baskets. He was pleased with everything that he did and learned, and the days and months passed quickly. But he learned more from the river than Vasudeva could teach him. He learned from it continually. Above all, he learned from it how to listen with a still heart, with a waiting, open soul, without passion, without desire, without judgment, without opinions.
Charles, thank you. Matthew, it's another passage about listening, isn't it? About learning to listen. Is that important to a musician, obviously in a literal sense, but beyond the literal sense?
I think so, yeah. I mean, listening is just a fascinating subject. And also, I find that listening for me as an improviser teaches me a huge amount. And a lot of sort of quasi-spiritual teachings, like you might find in the Book of Siddhartha or something like that, will talk about the power of being in the moment. And for a lot of people, that's quite hard to grasp. What is the concept of really being in the moment? And for me, I just think of it in musical terms. It's just listening. If you're listening to anything, you are in the moment. It's as simple as that. Whether that's a river or a piece of music or Charles reading or whatever it is, you just are there automatically. And I think that listening, I mean, the hardest thing for me as a musician in listening is when I practice. When I perform, it's quite easy. When I'm improvising, it's quite easy. But to really bring that quality of attention when I'm practicing, because practicing is boring, actually. You know, you're sitting there on your own, you've got to do all that stuff. But if you can really bring a quality of listening to your practice, then it improves things so fast. So listening on many levels, very important.
There's an insistence on physical labour here as well, though, isn't there? You know, when he's not needed for the ferry, he's working in the rice fields, he's picking bananas. And it runs through the passages that you've chosen, a sense of the kind of physical body and it actually working, which strikes me as also rather important to your musicianship. Very physical activity.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that. It is, yes.
You wrap yourself around the cello and work at it.
Absolutely, yes. On a good day.
On a good day. The next of your passages is a story of great human love. It's Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago, which was smuggled out of the Soviet Union to be published in the West in 1957. And this love between the writer Yuri and Lara, which goes on through revolution and war, across immense distances of time and place, it's become part of the European imagination. And here, in this passage, that love is resolved at last in Yuri's death. Charles.
The whole of her was shaken by the sobs which she restrained. She fought her tears as long as she could. But at times it was beyond her strength, and they burst from her, pouring down her cheeks and falling on her dress, her hands, and the coffin to which she clung. She neither spoke nor thought. Many thoughts, generalizations, facts, certainties, swept and chased through her mind at will, as freely as clouds in the sky, or as their nighttime conversations in the past. This it was that had brought them happiness and liberation in those days. Knowledge, not from the head, but warm knowledge imparted to each other, instinctive, immediate. Such knowledge filled her now, a dark, indistinct knowledge of death, a preparedness for death, which removed all helplessness in its presence.
And how Russian. Thank you, Charles. Matthew, why does Dr. Zhivago speak particularly to you?
Well, I suppose going by my original criteria of needing to be moved by a book, it most certainly does that. I mean, it is one of the most moving stories of all time. But I think there's another thing that, for me, being a Russian book, and in fact, I only read it a few years ago. I studied in Russia for 2 years in my early 20s and learned to speak Russian reasonably well, not well enough to read Russian. And I said to myself, okay, someday I'm going to really study so I can read Pasternak, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. And I just never got round to it. So consequently, my knowledge of Russian literature is actually really bad. So a few years ago, I thought, right, time to just read them in English, you know, because it's not going to happen in Russian. And that was the first one I read. And it was extraordinary because, well, as an Englishman, knowing Russia a little bit, it resonated so strongly. It is so Russian. And it's hard to put your finger, I guess, on every aspect of that, but one of them would be simply that there is so much suffering in that book on every level. A lot of it is set in the 20s when the White Army and the Red Army were fighting. And the scale of suffering and death, I mean, we see it in Libya at the moment, but if you multiply that over so many years by so many thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, it's quite astonishing. It's hard to get to grips with. And Pasternak's commentary, which covered, I think, about 20 years, because it finished just after the Second World War, is filled with that on the political level, on the sort of country level.
I mean, he wrote it in these dark, dark days. And do you think that the story of the love between Yuri and Lara is actually an assertion of the power of personal love against the state? Or do you think there is in there some implication that it's possible for there to be a nation that can be with that, with which that love can be kind of congruent? Is it always that only the personal feeling you give up on the state?
Yeah, I think it's probably more the former. I wouldn't say it was necessarily against the state, although, you know, Pasternak was vilified by the authorities after he wrote it, very much so. But it's more, I think it's more a love that would go sort of above the state, or that's bigger. I mean, there's another lovely passage where he describes love as being something that's so gigantic and something that's so, for him, concretely comes from the universe, from nature, that the idea of man exalting himself to the position where politics are the most important is ridiculous. So that's not really against the state, but obviously if you are the state, that would seem that way.
We go to the other side of the world for your last reading. The novelist Patrick White engaged with the Australian bush and whether it could really be seen through the spectacles of the European cultural tradition that Australian settlers had brought with them. The Tree of Man, published in 1955, opens with the first axe strokes in native forest. Charles.
A cart drove between the two big stringy barks and stopped. These were the dominant trees in that part of the bush, rising above the involved scrub with the simplicity of true grandeur. So the cart stopped, grazing the hairy side of a tree, and the horse, shaggy and stolid as the tree, sighed and took root. The man who sat in the cart got down. He rubbed his hands together because already it was cold, a curdle of cold cloud in a pale sky and copper in the west. On the air you could smell the frost. As the man rubbed his hands, the friction of cold skin intensified the coldness of the air and the solitude of the place. Birds looked from twigs, and the eyes of animals were drawn to what was happening. The man lifting the bundle from a cart, a dog lifting his leg on an anthill, the lip drooping on the sweaty horse. Then the man took an axe and struck at the side of a hairy tree, more to hear the sound than for any other reason, and the sound was cold and loud. The man struck at the tree and struck till several white chips had fallen. He looked at the scar in the side of the tree. The silence was immense. It was the first time anything like this had happened in that part of the bush.
Thank you, Charles. Two generations later, I think there'll be a large settlement there. Matthew, this passage has extraordinary auditory quality, doesn't it? You hear the horse sighing, you see, hear the silence, you hear the axe striking, you hear the silence again. Mm-hmm. Is silence important?
Well, yeah, I mean, silence as a musician is incredibly important. I think the silence to a musician is as a blank canvas is to a painter. It's what everything sits upon. And yeah, it's the silence that really struck me about this. I was looking through the book as a passage, and the first thing I obviously turned to was the first page, and then I tried about 10 or 20 other passages, but kept on coming back to that one, because somehow it's so much what Australia is about for me. And I first read Patrick White about 4 or 5 years ago. I'd been working in Australia, and I had a week free between some work in Brisbane and in Melbourne. And so I thought, okay, I'll hire one of those gigantic camper vans, and I drove due west right into the outback and then south down to Melbourne. And it was extraordinary. It was one of the greatest adventures of my life. But when you're out there, I mean, certainly the emptiness strikes you, but the silence for a European is something quite extraordinary. It's so enormous.
It also has a kind of visionary quality. It's almost cathedral-like, the big silence, the spaces. So although it's not immediately obviously religious, it comes in line with some of the other more explicitly theological passages that you've chosen. Would you consider yourself a religious man?
I suppose I wouldn't consider myself religious at all, in that that implies a religion. But I think one of the things I love about all these passages is that the spirituality is always undogmatic. And I connect with things on a spiritual level very, very much, but I love the way, especially in Siddhartha, it's so concretely illuminated that you cannot learn through words. And for me, that's really important, that it's nature, music, things like that, that convey the true spirituality of my world.
Matthew Barley speaking to Susan Hitch in this evening's Proms Plus literary event. The readings were by Charles Dance and the producer was Gavin Hurd. Well, a warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall this Saturday night. Petroc Trelawney with you on BBC Radio 3 and a concert given by Switzerland's oldest orchestra, the Zurich Tonhalle, founded in 1868. It was in 1895 that it moved into the Tonhalle building, which has a remarkable acoustic. Has remained the orchestra's home ever since. Well, the players making their way back onto the platform. There's just one more work to come tonight, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, his third symphony. a work that famously was going to be dedicated to Napoleon Bonaparte. Alas, when the Frenchman declared himself emperor and became, in the composer's view, just another tyrant, Beethoven angrily scratched his name off the symphony's title page. When the work was first heard publicly in 1805, it was greeted with suspicion and scepticism. Such a long, complex, strangely constructed work redefined what the word symphony meant, and not everyone was happy. I talked about the radical nature of the work earlier today with David Zinman.
Well, you can see why it is radical and shocking, because it changed the course of music, essentially, and the way it uses its motives. It has, you know, a rhythmic motive which goes through the entire piece, and it has short melodic motives, and yet it's a big, long piece. He spins out everything with it, and it's shocking in a way, because just the way it begins with this kind of two very gruff chords, and those two little chords are actually the basis of the whole piece. And then to have an idea of a first movement and then a slow movement, which is a funeral march, and then a scherzo, and it goes from really dark gently towards light as well, and so it's a novelistic symphony as well, and it's the first time. And then of course the last movement, that's a set of variations on a tune that he had great success with. So I think he thought maybe he was too serious in the first two movements, and he had to do something to have some kind of success at the end. And of course, who knows what would have happened if Napoleon had turned out to be the different kind of person. But I think this is not about Napoleon, it's about Beethoven himself and his struggle with his fate as well.
There's a great picture in the Proms program tonight of the original score with Napoleon literally scratched out by Beethoven.
Right, right.
So he's the great man, you think, of the piece?
Beethoven, yes, absolutely. And what's interesting is to think about what happened in the ravine between the First and the Third Symphony, and what happened to him in his life, what happened in politics, what happened, of course, to his health. And his health was a great problem to him. And, of course, he didn't know whether he would be able to continue as a composer. So a lot of this is in this piece. And there's so much detail in the piece. It's like super Haydn, but over the top, totally over the top. And anger. And I think Beethoven is the first one who can write anger like nobody else.
Tonight's conductor, David Zinman. Well, when Beethoven played the work on the piano to Ferdinand Ries, he was overwhelmed. I believe that heaven and earth must tremble beneath when it is performed. Berlioz described the second movement, Funeral March, as funeral games around the grave of the warrior, such as those in the Iliad. David Zinman conducts the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra in Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Zinman conducting the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra here at the BBC Proms. Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E-flat major. His heroic symphony, composed to celebrate the memory of a great man. David Zinman returns to the platform, the New York-born conductor who studied with Pierre Monteur, made his debut conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra back in 1967. Now in his mid-70s, this his 16th season as music director of the Tonhalle Orchestra. He's recently signed a new contract with them, which will keep him there through until 2015, pretty much to his 80th birthday. Though, as he told me the other day on In Tune, whether he will retire or not at that point, it's a matter still to be decided. Vast amounts of energy and enthusiasm the orchestra gave this concert in Zurich at the Tonhalle two nights ago. And with a change of symphony, Dvorak rather than Beethoven, they take it now to the Edinburgh International Festival. I think we could say elegant restraint, the mantra of tonight's concert. Both soloist and conductor and orchestra indeed, acting as a perfect conduit to present purely the intentions of first Mozart and then Beethoven. David Zinman back again, arms wide open, as he brings the orchestra to its feet. Julia Becker, our concertmaster this evening. The Rotterdam Philharmonic, Rochester Philharmonic in the States, and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra amongst the orchestras that Zinman has been music director of. Has a discography of over 100 recordings, Mahler's symphonies with the Zurich Tonhalle Orchestra, his latest release. Recording of the Brahms symphonies will be released in the autumn, and he's currently recording the Schubert symphonies. Well, the audience have got rhythm tonight, that's for sure, as David Zinman returns once again. The orchestra stand again. We're going to have an encore.
The same, but different.
Well, that was the finale from Beethoven's Creatures of Prometheus. The same but different, said David Zinman. A starting point for his Eroica Symphony. He took the final theme from Prometheus, a rich theme that he'd already used as the basis of a ballroom dance and created a set of variations for piano around it. So too was it to inspire his Eroica Symphony. David Zinman, conducting the Tanhalle Orchestra Zurich here at the BBC Proms. If you joined us late and missed Maria João Pires playing Mozart's K595 Piano Concerto, or indeed the rather beautiful Cold Heat by Anders Hillborg, which opened our programme tonight, you can hear them again when this prom is repeated on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock on BBC Radio 3. And if you can't wait that long, a bit later on this evening, it'll be available to listen to on the BBC iPlayer. Well, with that, we reach the end of tonight's prom. Tomorrow here at the Royal Albert Hall, Mendelssohn's Elijah, sung by choirs from Berkshire, Northern Ireland, Manchester and Wroclaw in Poland. Paul McCreesh conducts the Gabrielli Consort, and a stellar lineup of British soloists, Rosemary Joshua, Sarah Connolly, Robert Murray and Simon Keenly's side. That's tomorrow night at 7. For now, though, from the Royal Albert Hall, very good night to you. And back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you. Petrock Trelawney there. And keeping Beethoven very much in sight, there's a performance of his Fifth Symphony in Through the Night tonight in the concert starting at 1 o'clock. Myung Hun Chung conducting the French Radio Philharmonic. And back at the proms, there's this.
It could just be the most provocative symphonic statement ever made. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony gets its annual performance at the BBC Proms. Join us for one of the highlights of each and every prom season, Wednesday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
We're back to this evening in a little under 10 minutes tonight. Between the Years, the home of innovative feature-making on Radio 3, Kerry Shale performs The Man with the Blue Guitar by Wallace Stevens, with reflections on the poem and the Picasso painting that inspired it from David Hockney, among others. As Petrock mentioned just now, you can hear Mendelssohn's magnificent oratorio Elijah in tomorrow night's prom, something on a smaller scale from him now, one of his songs. It's Faith in Spring, Frühlingsglaube. The singer is Margaret Price and the pianist Graham Johnson. Mendelssohn's song Frühlingsglaube, Faith in Spring, sung there by Dame Margaret Price with the pianist Graham Johnson. We'll follow it music by the Frenchman Albert Roussel, born a little after Debussy and just before Ravel, and perhaps not quite as distinctive as either, but once you're inside his world, it's quite addictive, the individual twists of harmony and the superb craftsmanship. The music is Roussel's Divertissement for piano and wind quintet, and this recording made in 1989 with a group of France's finest wind players and the pianist Pascal Roger. Thank you. Music from 1906 by Roussel, his Divertissement, Opus 6, with flautist Catherine Quentin, oboist Maurice Bourg, clarinetist Michel Portal, bassoonist Amaury Vallée, horn player André Cazalet, and pianist Pascal Roger. Aside to Roussel there, we don't often hear less astringent, rather gentler than usual. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10 o'clock and now Between the Ears, the home of innovative feature-making on Radio 3. Kerry Shale performs The Man with the Blue Guitar by Wallace Stevens, with reflections on the poem and the Picasso painting that inspired it from David Hockney, the poets Sue Hubbard and Dana Joya, and with new music for blue guitar composed and played by Martin Simpson.
The Man with the Blue Guitar by Wallace Stevens. The man bent over his guitar, a shearsman of sorts. The day was green. They said, "You have a blue guitar. You do not play things as they are." The man replied, "Things as they are changed upon the blue guitar." And they said then, "But play you must, a tune beyond us, yet ourselves. A tune upon the blue guitar of things exactly as they are."
I'm David Hockney, a painter, artist. I read it when I was staying in the Pines on Fire Island, about 1976, and I thought it was terrific. I read it first to myself, and then I read it out aloud to myself, which is very good because you then get the rhythms that are in it, especially the guitar rhythms and things. And I thought it was terrific. You realise what it's about the imagination transforming things. But obviously the guitar was the imagination. He'd been inspired by Picasso.
I cannot bring a world quite round, although I patch it as I can. I sing a hero's head, large eye, and bearded bronze, but not a man. Although I patch him as I can and reach through him almost to man, if to serenade almost to man is to miss by that things as they are, say that it is the serenade of a man that plays a blue guitar.
I'm Sue Hubbard, and I'm a poet and a novelist, and I write about art. Picasso's painting, The Old Guitarist from the Blue Period, is the springboard for Wallace Stevens, The Man with the Blue Guitar. It's a strange and rather melancholy painting. By definition, it's blue. But the man is sitting perhaps on a street corner. He's dejected. He's got torn rags of clothes. And he's clutching a guitar. And the sense of the painting is really one of the outsider, and that the only thing he has in the world is this guitar. It's almost as though he's clutching his soul. And I think what Picasso is talking about in this painting is the solitary bohemian existence of the artist and the struggle of the artistic life.
Ah, but to play man number one, to drive the dagger in his heart, to lay his brain upon the board and pick the acrid colors out, to nail his thought across the door, its wings spread wide to rain and snow, to strike his living high and ho, to tick it, talk it, turn it true, to bang it from a savage blue, jangling the metal of the strings.
I was very turned on by it, so I actually, later that year, I just started some little etchings. I mean, I only did perhaps a couple, just playing with the ideas in it. And then I realized I could do a few, actually, for it. I think I finished up making about 20. You have Picasso's imagery to play with. I mean, for me at that time, it was a very exciting thing. It seemed rich material for me.
So, that's life then. Things as they are. It picks its way on the blue guitar. A million people on one string, and all their manner in the thing, and all their manner right and wrong, and all their manner weak and strong. And that's life then. Things as they are. This buzzing of the blue guitar.
Well, that was a challenge. I thought, how would you do a buzzing of a blue guitar? It's a good subject. It's utterly non-visual, really. So how do you do it visually? And I suggested the sound by these kind of waving curtains that the sound would make and move it and things. It's just a suggestion, but the idea of drawing a sound would appeal to me.
Do not speak to us of the greatness of poetry, of the torches wisping in the underground, of the structure of vaults upon a point of light. There are no shadows in our sun. Day is desire, and night is sleep. There are no shadows anywhere. The earth, for us, is flat and bare. There are no shadows. Poetry, exceeding music, must take the place of empty heaven and its hymns. Ourselves in poetry must take their place, even in the chattering of your guitar.
I'm Dana Gioia. I'm a poet and a critic. And the basic argument of the poem is really quite simple. How do we make sense in a world in which we no longer have religious myths that give order to life and the universe? And what Stevens says is that poetry becomes a substitute for religion. And by poetry, what Stevens means is the imagination, where he says poetry exceeding music must take the place of empty heaven and its hymns. Now, this is not, dare I say, a small ambition. And so Stevens, you know, is sort of setting up a new myth by which to live. And he has a very simple explanation. He says that we have reality, which is, in his mind, pretty much the natural world. We have the imagination, which is our ability to take reality and make it subjective, and that the imagination working with reality has to create a fiction, a myth, a poem, as it were, that replaces religion, which we no longer can accept. And Picasso becomes one of the models by which the imagination creates a new view of reality. So you can say that what this really is a philosophical, even a theological poem, which uses art, poetry, the imagination as the basis for a new world order.
Attune beyond us as we are, yet nothing changed by the blue guitar. Ourselves in the tune as if in space, yet nothing changed except the place of things as they are, and only the place as you play them on the blue guitar, placed so, beyond the compass of change, perceived in a final atmosphere, for a moment final, in the way the thinking of art seems final when the thinking of God is smoky dew. The tune is space. The blue guitar becomes the place of things as they are, a composing of senses of the guitar.
I think one reason that Picasso's The Old Guitarist haunted Stevens, above and beyond the sheer genius of that painting, was that Stevens himself played the guitar. He was, by all reports, a rather bad guitarist. But the notion of sort of bending over a guitar and picking notes and using it as a kind of meditation was something that he knew personally.
The vivid, florid, turgid sky, the drenching thunder rolling by, the morning deluged still by night, the clouds tumultuously bright, and the feeling heavy in cold chords, struggling toward impassioned choirs, crying among the clouds, enraged by gold antagonists in air. I know my lazy, leaden twang is like the reason in a storm, and yet it brings the storm to bear. I twang it out and leave it there. And the color, the overcast blue of the air, in which the blue guitar is a form, described but difficult. And I am merely a shadow, hunched above the arrowy, still string, the maker of a thing yet to be made, the color like a thought that grows out of a mood, the tragic robe of the actor, half his gesture, half his speech, the dress of his meaning, silk sodden with his melancholy words, the weather of his stage, himself.
When you read a long poem like that, first of all, you don't get it all immediately. It's like a piece of complicated music. You don't hear it all. So I'd find things, little images, play with the idea of colours, using the colours you're using, things like that.
A painting is by definition silent, and words are by necessity conceptual rather than pictorial. And so what Stevens is trying to do is to say, how does one create the effect of a painting in a poem? Stevens is using colors deliberately. I don't know how many times the word blue appears in this long poem, but it's constantly there as a kind of motif. But he creates these series of colors. Green represents the sun, interestingly enough. It's creativity. Red is some kind of vanished belief system. He's got gold, which represents these no longer existent gods. He has bronze for the kind of heroes that mankind has made. And he's using these colors very deliberately in a very painterly way.
Tom, Tom, c'est moi. The blue guitar and I are one. The orchestra fills the high hall with shuffling men, high as the hall. The whirling noise of a multitude dwindles. All said to his breath that lies awake at night. I know that timid breathing. Where do I begin and end? And where, as I strum the thing, do I pick up that which momentously declares itself not to be I, and yet must be? It could be nothing else.
Well, you might say that art in the past played things as they are, showed the world to us as we thought, at least, it was. What, of course, Picasso does and goes on later to do in Cubism is to show that reality is an abstraction with many perspective possibilities. And I think it is actually this patchworking that Wallace Stevens particularly takes up. The guitar here doesn't express reality. The imagination isn't reality, but they do share qualities. A tune beyond us, yet ourselves, and things exactly as they are. So it is both part of us and not part of us. It can only be a creative act. It can't be the thing itself.
First one beam, then another, then a thousand are radiant in the sky. Each is both star and orb, and day is the riches of their atmosphere. The sea appends its tattery hues. The shores are banks of muffling mist. One says a German chandelier. A candle is enough to light the world. It makes it clear. Even at noon, it glistens in essential dark. At night, it lights the fruit and wine, the book and bread, things as they are. In a chiaroscuro, where one sits and plays the blue guitar.
Stevens thought of Picasso as the emblematic modern artist. And at one point, midway through the poem, he quotes Picasso, just this phrase of Picasso that Stevens actually saw in a French magazine, Cahiers d'Art, on an issue that they had done on surrealism. So it's Picasso talking about something decades later than this 1903 painting. And Picasso says that un somme de destruction, the sum or an accumulation of destruction, which Stevens translates slightly more flamboyantly as this horde of destruction. You know, it's almost as if it's a kind of military aftermath which has left destruction in its wake. It's a very colorful translation, which is basically a symbol of society. And he takes this one later quote of Picasso, and it becomes a kind of symbol for, you know, one of the major ideas in the poem, which is that what we're left with in the modern era is no longer a belief system that works, no longer a civilization that works. What we're left with is a kind of junk heap, a bunch of ruins of a society which is no longer functioning.
Is this picture of Picasso's, this horde of destructions, a picture of ourselves now, an image of our society? Do I sit deformed, a naked egg, catching at goodbye, harvest moon, without seeing the harvest or the moon? Things as they are have been destroyed. Have I? Am I a man that is dead, at a table on which the food is cold? Is my thought a memory, not alive? Is the spot on the floor there? Wine or blood, and whichever it may be, is it mine? A dream, to call it a dream, in which I can believe, in face of the object, a dream no longer a dream, a thing, of things as they are, as the blue guitar, after long strumming on certain nights, gives the touch of the senses, not of the hand, but the very senses as they touch the wind gloss. Or as daylight comes, like light in a mirroring of cliffs, rising upward from a sea of X.
We made a little book. I've forgotten how many we printed. It was done in 1977. It was called The Blue Guitar, Etchings by David Hockney, who was inspired by Wallace Stevens, who was inspired by Pablo Picasso. So it worked, and we probably did maybe 2,000 copies of this book.
What is there in life except one's ideas? Good air, good friend. What is there in life? Is it ideas that I believe? Good air, my only friend. Believe, believe would be a brother full of love. Believe would be a friend, friendlier than my only friend, good air. Poor pale guitar. Poetry is the subject of the poem. From this poem issues, and to this returns. Between the two, between issue and return, there is an absence in reality. Things as they are, or so we say. But are these separate? Is it an absence for the poem, which acquires its true appearances there? Sun's green, clouds red, earth feeling, sky that thinks. From these it takes, perhaps it gives, in the universal intercourse.
Of course, we have to remember that this poem was published in the 30s, and there was a huge uncertainty in American culture, I suppose, between the certainties of religion and atheism and agnosticism. And this poem explores all that. That is why I suppose one could say that the actual subject of the poem is poetry itself, that the only meaning that can be achieved is the process of making art. And this is, I think, one of the things that Wallace Stevens actually took from Picasso, that you have all these shards and all you can do is put them back together again in some form which will give you the poet or the artist's version of reality. There is nothing beyond it. Though, of course, Stevens, in a sense, because he was a deeply philosophical poet, I think, is always searching for an existential meaning. So there's that dichotomy, there's that tension in the poem, things being what they are, but never being able to be what they are.
A poem like a missile found in the mud, a missile for that young man, that scholar hungriest for that book, the very book, or less, a page, or, at the least, a phrase, that phrase, a hawk of life, that Latined phrase. To know, a missile for brooding sight, to meet that hawk's eye and to flinch not at the eye, but at the joy of it. I play, but this is what I think.
Stevens is a very odd poet because he is essentially a philosophical poet, but he is almost incapable of creating a linear structure. And so his structure is musical. Stevens tends to circle around the idea again and again, almost like a theme in variations. And so I think one of the interesting things about The Man with the Blue Guitar is that he is creating a musical set of variations on, as it were, the imaginary unheard tune that's being played by Picasso's musician.
How long and late the pheasant sleeps. The employer and the employee contend, combat, compose their droll affair. The bubbling sun will bubble up, spring sparkle, and the cockbird shriek. The employer and employee will hear and continue their affair. The shriek will rack the thickets. There is no place here for the lark fixed in the mind in the museum of the sky. The cock will claw sleep. Morning is not sun. It is this posture of the nerves, as if a blunted player clutched the nuances of the blue guitar. It must be this rhapsody or none, the rhapsody of things as they are.
The poem has 33 sections. The poem is an homage to Dante. You know, each of the sections of Dante's comedy have 33 sections, and there's finally a 34th that make it 100. Dante describes the meaning of life by showing how life relates to this vast theological geography of the afterlife. Stevens is saying we have no afterlife, but he creates a parallel structure as a way of saying, I mean business. This is a serious poem. This is the poem that gives you my worldview.
Throw away the lights, the definitions, and say of what you see in the dark, that it is this or that it is that, but do not use the rotted names. How should you walk in that space and know nothing of the madness of space, nothing of its jocular procreations? Throw the lights away. Nothing must stand between you and the shapes you take when the crust of shape has been destroyed. You, as you are yourself. The blue guitar surprises you.
Things as they are changed upon the blue guitar. It's wonderful. I mean, it's true. Imagination changes things. I mean, isn't failure of imagination a tragedy, our tragedy, really? I mean, I always think so. Most failures are from failure of imagination, in a way. It's a powerful piece, I think, a very powerful poem. It is. It is deep. Yes, it is. Things as they are changed upon the blue guitar. It's a very good line, isn't it?
That generation's dream, aviled in the mud, in Monday's dirty light. That's it. The only dream they knew. Time in its final block. Not time to come. A wrangling of two dreams. Here is the bread of time to come. Here is its actual stone. The bread will be our bread. The stone will be our bed. And we shall sleep by night. We shall forget by day, except the moments when we chose to play the imagined pine, the imagined jay.
The Man with the Blue Guitar was performed by Kerry Shale, with music composed and played by Martin Simpson. You also heard the painter David Hockney and the poets Sue Hubbard and Dana Joya. Between the Ears was produced by Julian May.
In the BBC Radio 3 lunchtime concert, Magdalena Kozina, Simon Keenly-Side, the Belcher Quartet, Marta Argerich and Nelson Gurner. And that's just the first of 3 weeks of coverage of the best chamber concerts at the 2011 Edinburgh International Festival. Every year in Scotland's capital city, we have the opportunity to hear the finest chamber music the world has to offer. So whether it's the grandeur of the Usher Hall or the intimacy of the Queen's Hall, take the best seat in the house by joining me, Jamie McDougall, and my colleague Mary-Ann Kennedy for 3 weeks in Edinburgh in the Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert, Tuesdays to Fridays from 1 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Back to this evening, it's 29 minutes to 11 and time now for Here and Now with Ivan Hewitt.
Hello and welcome to Here and Now and the second of two Antipodean-themed programmes. The City of London Festival focused this year on music from Australia and New Zealand, and tonight we'll be featuring a festival concert given by Australia's foremost new music group, the Elysian Ensemble. The group's director is Daryl Buckley and he'll be joining me in the studio a little later. But let's set the ball rolling with the first piece. It's by Michael Finnessy, who isn't Australian at all. In fact, he's about as English as they come. But like several English composers who've spent time in Australia, he's been hugely inspired by the strangeness and the sheer size of the Australian landscape, and by the ancient mythologies of the Aboriginal people who lived there. Several pieces came out of that experience, and we're going to hear one of them now. It's called Ajal, which is the ancient Aboriginal name for sky. Here it is now, played by the Elysian Ensemble.